Mr. Hitchcock, Reel 9. We were talking about when you got these German ships back to Plymouth and the reception from the civilian population.
We went close alongside and saw our former enemies. And the local press went what we would call bananas nowadays over the episode. And I think it was the Western Morning News or Western Morning Herald published, and I've got a copy of this publication. Talking about the surrender in Khorsan Bay, which was really quite an event. And as I said, the people in Plymouth came out on the Ho, danced up and down. There were cheers and shouts. You could hear these coming across the water, because people really felt the war was over. Narborough at that stage became a duty vessel and was sent out to Foy. So VE Day comes round and we are finding ourselves sailing up the coast to Foy to pick up a China clay ship and bring it along the coast to Plymouth. Now, this wasn't a very pleasing episode in our story, because when we got to Foy, we had to wait for the ship to come down. We got in the morning, it was a lovely summer's day, and early summer's day, and the China clay ship was a great big lumbering thing. It seemed as though it was sailing between the land. But it was, of course, the Foy River. It came slowly down, and then anchored. We were allowed to go ashore until this vessel was ready to go to Plymouth. We went ashore, knocked on the door of the first pub, the only pub in this area, and, of course, they had no beer. They shut up shop and said, oh, we're saving it for tonight. This is VE Day. We thought, well, St. Austell isn't far away. We'll go to St. Austell. We set off for St. Austell, suddenly realised that we couldn't possibly get there, so we got a ride on the back of a lorry and came back again. That was the sum total of my VE Day celebrations, because when we returned to Plymouth, we ended up in the Sound, that is the outer harbour, along with quite a lot of other war vessels, destroyers, escorts, all kind of ships. And we could see the bonfires on the Ho in the evening, people dancing up and down, having a jolly good time, whereas we were not. And there were some, I don't say what the messages were that were sent by our main searchlights to Mount Wise, but I dare say there may be a record of these. The troops were not pleased. So we ended our VE Day celebrations being told off for flashing the Admiral with uncomplimentary remarks and singing what are loosely called on the radio patriotic songs with one of the Polish ships, the Piorun, equally not deemed worthy of a run ashore. Soon after this, next day or the day after, we set sail again. This time we went on a long trip to Wilhelmshaven. Now, Wilhelmshaven was the main German naval base on the North Sea. And there we were able, first of all, to get ashore. In order to go ashore in Wilhelmshaven, several days after the war had ended, we had to take a weapon. Narborough didn't have Sten guns and things that you could use of that type, but we were given by the garrison, the British garrison, German Schmeitzer machine pistols. And this was a blooming heavy thing. I thought, I know why the Germans lost the war. Their guns were too heavy to carry around. This was, of course, somewhat jocular, but nonetheless, there is a grain of truth in this, that the Germans had a very tight inspection process, And they literally were unable to produce, in some cases, enough guns of the high quality that they demanded. And the Schmeitzer pistol was heavy to tote around. Either you had to be a giant and very strong, but sailors, after all, were not particularly fit because you've been at sea for a long time, you didn't get ashore very often, sometimes you were seasick, you didn't eat good food, and sometimes you drank too much. So there was all sorts of disabilities. However, we sailed past one of the German cruisers, the Prinz Eugen, which was anchored out at Wilhelmshaven, and came into the inner port where we were able to take photographs, at least surreptitious photographs, of the German U-boats that had plagued us during our trip to Russia and so on. And I have a photograph of that time of U-133. Can you read the name, Hans?
Yeah.
The U-133 was a modern German U-boat, and we set off with this eventually, having been ashore and seen the smouldering remains of Wilhelmshaven. U-133 was augmented by three other U-boats, and we took these all the way round the north of Scotland to what we thought was going to be Lissahalli, but eventually turned out to be Loch Ryan. That's where they ended up.
Anything about the trip?
The trip was uneventful. The sea was kind, and from then on, Narborough spent most of its time pottering around. We went back to Portsmouth, back to Plymouth, and sailed our next venture, for which I have the signal of commendation from the naval officer in charge of Cardiff. Our next venture was to go to Cardiff, show the flag, do what was called a Navy Day. We had a naval week in Cardiff, showing off the ships that had won the Battle of the Atlantic.
What was that like, the naval week?
Well, the ship was so-called dressed overall, and I have a photograph of Narborough alongside the docks in Bute Street, or the Bute Sea, the Bute Street docks, dressed overall. On your days ashore, you were invited to dances. You met, of course, with girls. And when you were aboard, you showed the ship off to the many visitors who came and kept them out of places where things might go for walkabout. On the whole, people coming were very interested to see the ships that were labelled as winning the Battle of the Atlantic. These ships, frigates, captain class, numbered some 78. They didn't all survive. Some 18 were sunk, and over 700 men were killed. Captain class frigates replaced by lease lend the American four stackers, which Churchill had negotiated in the early days of the war. Remember, I was drafted first of all to one of these, the St. Albans.
So what happened after the Cardiff naval week?
From Cardiff we went back to Plymouth, pottered around, did little until the next major mission, which stands out in my memory, was to take one of the U-boats that we had so carefully brought from Wilhelmshaven to Russia. These were called gifts or souvenirs for the Russians. Many British ships had earlier on ended up in Russian hands. I think this was simply a ploy to get the Russians to actually help us out in the north, or prevent them having too many souvenirs. However, we went to Lissahalli, that is the base in the River Foyle where we'd begun our story, and towed from Lissahalli, partly under its own steam, because towing doesn't mean that the ship is totally, or the ship being towed is totally useless. Nonetheless, we were towing this vessel to Russia. We didn't go the North Cape way. We went through the Baltic. So the story is one of tows parting, losing this ship. The crew was British submariners. And we sailed north. We sailed through the Pentland Firth, that's between the north of Scotland and the Orkneys. Tows broke in the rough weather, which we experienced. Towing a submarine is not like towing a ship. A submarine bounces up and down and puts a big strain on the tow. But then our experience is always that tows break anyway. We sailed out into the North Sea, and the next lot of tows broke. It's quite a business getting a tow on board when the weather is rough. You throw a heaving line across, then a heaving rope is hauled up, and finally the tow on the end of the rope is pulled in and lashed to the vessel being towed. We set off down out into the North Sea, and tows parted again. Eventually we had none left. These that had gone were steel hawsers, and when they break, they go with a twang. We moved to Methil along the Scottish coast and picked up more tows, the last one being made of coconut fibre. We then sailed out into the North Sea, hoping to reach our destination before the winter closed in. Out in the sea, more gales followed, and the tows that we had, one by one, parted. Eventually, this wretched submarine was going around in the middle of a gale, in the middle of the North Sea, on half a starboard engine, doing half a knot on the starboard engine, and that was about all it could do. We had to get it to the nearest port possible, which proved to be southern Norway, that is Kristiansund. We managed to get the tows mended and towed the U-boat into Kristiansund, where we stayed for about a week. On one occasion, our number one thought that the members of the crew ought to go to church service. Of course, sailors often take every opportunity to go ashore, to get away from it, and those who went to church service found themselves in the middle of an incomprehensible Norwegian confirmation service, where lots of little girls were going up in white frocks to be brought into the church. I managed to find in Kristiansund a British paratrooper who for some reason had been sent north away from his regiment, from his groups, partly because he was a rescuer, partly because of the amount of loot he'd found in Germany. He told me the stories of the loot trains that were captured by paratroopers, because they were often the first in the field. However, I managed to get a lorry, go to the German stores in Kristiansund, and with the help of the paratrooper and the German colonel, who is still in charge of Kristiansund, pick up a lorry load of comforts for the troops. And I've still got one of the items, which was a German folder for letter papers, envelopes, and I suppose the Germans wish to encourage their troops to write home to tell Mum and Dad that they were still alive and healthy. I also got £40 of best Danish butter, and I was given huge tins of peaches. So when this lorry came back, I had my pick, and we packed up the duty watch to come and pick up comforts for the troops. And these amounted to quite interesting things, such as sheepskin coats, a whole range of German warfare, but a lot of it was Norwegian as well. But I managed to acquire a German Kriegsmarine sweater. The only difference between theirs and ours was they had little buttons on the shoulder to fasten up, so you didn't have to stretch your sweater round your neck as the simplistic English would have you do. From Kristiansund, with a repaired U-boat with tows, we had quite a hairy journey through the different parts of the Baltic, parts which I'd seen on maps, such as the Skagerrak, the Kattegat, when we sailed quite close to Sweden and Denmark, and then further afield into the Baltic proper, past Poland, on our way, which we were told would be Leningrad. The Baltic, by this time, with all these excitements en route, had become frozen. The Gulf of Bothnia, which leads in to Leningrad, now known as St. Petersburg, was frozen over. There wasn't any chance of our getting to Leningrad. We pulled in to Latvia, not even into Riga, the capital, but into a coastal port called Libau or Lipaja. And Lipaja was freezing over by the time we got there. I have photographs taken in Lipaja of the U-boat, and certainly of our vessel there. These photographs are showing, or one shows, German prisoners of war. They were out in all weathers, all night, sometimes in their ordinary clothes. I began to wonder whether any of them would ever make it back. We went ashore. It was really a railway sidings, nothing much better. We didn't go into the town. We were able to have an impromptu game of football, and I had in my office a telephone connected with the Russian commandant of Lipaja. Not that I spoke Russian, but every now and again a lieutenant commander who looked quite different from the normal British sailor would come rushing up from below and say to me in English, "Any messages?" If there had been a message, I had to rush down, grab him and say, "You're wanted on the phone," whereupon he would gabble away in Russian for what appeared to me to be an interminable time. I have no idea what it was all about. This phone had been installed by a couple of Russian technicians, and we conversed quite freely in English, such as Tommy Lauton, Stanley Matthews, and that was that. They obviously were supporters of football. From Lipaja, or Lipia, depends on how you pronounce it, we sailed back. By this time, food was running short. I still kept my precious Danish butter in the fridge of the ship, and my tins of peaches were perfectly safe in my locker. However, food was short. We took aboard some Russian potatoes before we left, and these had been frozen. They were about the size of good-sized marbles and very sweet to the taste. We didn't eat much, so by the time I got back, although I hadn't been seasick all that much, I was still fairly thin once more. And so we returned back to this country, and that almost amounted to the end of our story, because our next journey was from Belfast back to Portsmouth to be paid off. And Narborough was paid off in December of 1945. Some of the crew were retained to take the vessel back to North America. The skipper left. We got a new skipper who was a Wavy Navy lieutenant commander, and we found soon after a skipper had left that he was promoted to commander. So when we met him, first of all, he was a lieutenant, soon to become a lieutenant commander, soon to become a commander, and all in a very short period of time. So, but he deserved his promotion because we felt that our lives were certainly in his hands, and he performed his duties with great skill.
Now, what you left the ship in December then?
I left the ship in December.
Were you demobilised then?
I was not demobilised right away. I went on leave and returned back to Pompey Barracks, or Portsmouth Barracks, Victory Barracks. And from Victory Barracks, I was sent back to HMS Mercury 2, this time to await a new draft. I didn't stay there very long, and I was soon sent back to Portsmouth. So I was shilly-shallying about in this country, around and about Portsmouth for a few weeks, when I was drafted to Naval Party 1734, which happened to be in Schleswig-Holstein, a place called HMS Royal Alfred. And there, I soon found myself in war-torn Europe, occupied Europe, and it was totally different from Wilhelmshaven. Schleswig-Holstein had been relatively untouched by war. Of course, Kiel had been blitzed by the British in a reprisal raid. Lübeck had been damaged also.
What were you doing there?
I was still a coder, by this time an experienced coder, and I was put in charge by a coder who passed on the mantle of coder in charge. I was in charge of the confidential...
This was HMS Alfred.
HMS Royal Alfred, yes. Naval Party 1734. They were one of the parties I'd seen in the early days at HMS Mercury 2. I went to Schleswig-Holstein with 80 marks. In order to go to Germany in those days, you had to go with a weapon. And I was given a gun, a Lee Enfield, and was walking around Portsmouth Barracks, ready for off, with my Lee Enfield, when I met a young bomb-happy, demob-happy sailor who said, "Hoo-hoo, where are you off to? I thought the war was over." And I said, "Well, I'm going to Naval Party 1734. He said, "Oh, I've just come back from Germany. Would you like some money?" He said, "It's no use to me." And he gave me 80 marks. These were in BAFs or in German marks. In point of fact, this guy did me a good turn because I lived on 80 marks for the rest of my time in Germany. I didn't have any expenses. You didn't have to buy anything. You could buy things in canteens, but there wasn't very much to buy. And I shall relate how I managed to turn the 80 marks into a lot of money.
Now, I'm not quite sure still what you were doing. You're a coder with the Naval Party. What is HMS Royal Alfred, and where were you in
HMS Royal Alfred was a shore base in Plern, which was a show barracks for the Kriegsmarine, the German sailors, during the time of Dönitz and company. They all visited there. They all, in fact, lived there at times. So it was a very superior place.
Plön.
Plön. P-L-O umlaut N. That goes over the top of the two little dots over the N, over the O.
And what were you actually doing? What was the Naval Party doing?
Naval Party was simply occupying Plön. And naval parties were communication parties, so most people did very little.
So So you've gone out in January, 47?
I went out in January and stayed there until the early spring and lived the life of Riley, really.
Well, tell me about this money-making scheme then.
It wasn't illegal, it was perfectly legal, and it was simply by going to play Housey Housey. There was a two-badge signalman, and to anyone who's in the Navy, a two-badge signalman means that he knows the ropes. He's been there a long time. And he said, come on with me to Housey Housey. By this time, I was in charge of the confidential book office, the communications office, quite by chance, because the guy who'd introduced me had cleared off and said, you know how to work the naval codes, you know how to work the American code machines, the Type X, you can be in charge. There was no officer in charge, anything of this kind. I was in charge. It's all very cavalier, as you can imagine. However, I went with the two-badge signalman to Housey Housey. He said, buy as many books as you can. I said, well, I can't look after so many books. He said, do as I tell you and you'll understand. I bought about 12 of these books, which were rather like raffle tickets. And you played the game of Housey Housey when you called up. And as luck would have it, I got a house. And I said, what do I do now? He said, shout out, house. I previously got a line, which I had to shout out. And I went along, after the evening's entertainment, to the petty officer writer running the show, and he gave me a chit, certifying that I had won some money on Tombola, or Housey Housey, as it's called in the Navy. I said, what do I do with this? He said, well, you can go and do what you like with it. I said to this, my mentor, I said, what do I do with this now? And he said, you go along to the post office and get yourself a post office savings bank book. You then put the chit, which allows you to deposit the number of marks on it in the post office savings bank. He said they will convert it into English money. And the money-making scheme became all apparent to me. There I used worthless German marks, which wouldn't buy me anything, other than a cup of coffee or whatever in the mess, or a glass of beer. And I suddenly found these turned into real money. So when I ended my time in Plön, I came back with about £50 in my post office savings bank in real money. This was monopoly gone riot.
Anything else happened from that?
Well, from Plön, I was one of the very last people to leave Plön because I was there to close it down. And I handed it over to the British Army, to the Guards regiments. It was, as I said, a showpiece. And the guards took it over for many years. I had a confidential book office. My job then, as we were closing down, was to hand over all the confidential books, naval codes, etc., drums, etc., to the Admiralty. And they were sent back in packing cases, provided me for the purpose. And I served to say that these were these had mustered here and I was sending them back. Now, there's an interesting story attached to this which comes up 14 years later when I am in the same room packing up books, sending them back to the headquarters in Rheindahlen. And how that comes about is another tale. However,